Hi, folks. Today, fellow old mole Jan Hocken and I, Bill Resnick, will discuss an alleged teenage mental health crisis. This discussion subject came to us by the New York Times, who published an article, actually a series of articles, the first one titled, It's Life or Death, the Mental Health Crisis Amongst U.S. Teens, very ominous. It begins, their article, and I quote, depression, self-harm, and suicide are rising among American adolescents. For one 13-year-old, the despair was almost too much to take. And then it describes this poor person. The Times then legitimated this warning of teenage mental health emergency by citing its sources. Here's again the Times, and I quote, in December, in a rare public advisory, the U.S. Surgeon General warned of a devastating mental health crisis among adolescents. Numerous hospital and doctor groups have called it a national emergency, citing rising levels of mental illness, a severe shortage of therapists and treatment options, and insufficient research to explain the trend. Jan Hocken, welcome to KBOO as a guest. Welcome to the old mole.
It's good to be talking with you about these serious problems.
Yes. Jan Hocken is a psychologist. For many years, he directed the Portland State University Psych Department's counseling unit. It trains people for counseling jobs across the economy. Jan's three books include Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD. That's post-traumatic stress disorder. And much of her writing on PTSD, on recovered memory of past abuse, on alleged satanic rituals and child care programs, in much of this writing, Jan critiques the tendency of psychologists and practitioners to exaggerate and sometimes fabricate the social problem that needs more attention. So, Jan, evaluate for us this devastating mental health crisis. How would you describe the situation of today's teens?
Well, like many reports of social crisis or what some call periods of moral panic when a particular issue crosses a threshold from a group gathering and organizing around a social problem to becoming identified as an acute and urgent problem that calls for a major shift in investment of resources. There's always something to it, as well as ways in which experts are competing in ways to frame and name the problem. And a lot of my work focuses on not just people who suffer mental health conditions or are diagnosed with conditions, but the conflict among experts who have various levels of authority in coming to terms with and calling for funding and support for services. I think it's interesting with this new data on suicidality in youth and the pandemic that these trends preceded the pandemic by some years, as some of the data started in 2002, 2008 to 2010, increasing rates of suicide attempts and suicide, particularly among vulnerable youth, youth of color, LGBTQ youth. But I think the pandemic has opened up space for more of a public health response to the problems of youth. That, you know, it doesn't take a psychiatrist to know that the pandemic has exacerbated a lot of problems for young people as well as for their caregivers. You know, youth centers have closed, schools have been shut down or curtailed services. So a lot of the ways in which young people find support and what are called the buffering effects or resilience factors, areas where youth are supported that reduces the likelihood of a psychiatric episode, including a suicide attempt. You know, there's been a loss of those services over the pandemic, but that's exacerbated a longer-term loss of public services for youth and support services for youth. So here, I think getting back to some of the data published by hospital psychiatrists, there are more youth presenting during the pandemic in emergency rooms, but that has been going on for a long time as well, that we've relied in this country on hospital emergency rooms for mental health care for decades because there are fewer services available outside of the criminal justice system. And so I think the answer isn't more psychiatric beds, which some psychiatrists are calling for, but there's another set of calls that are more oriented toward education and public health. So that's another, I think, point to take up. What this emergency or crisis is calling for specifically, and that's when you start digging into the numbers and how people are framing the crisis, where there's some differences that emerge in terms of what we need to do about the problems that youth confront.
Yeah, the Times defined the problem mostly in terms of the personal lives of these kids being disrupted. They looked at individual cases of kids and then extrapolated from that to the whole population. They got a letter back from a number of letters that gently critiqued them, too gently is my sense, but they're looking for causes in the wrong places, basically. Let me read to you the letter, and then we can comment on the very different way of understanding young people today. Here's the letter. As the mother of two teenage daughters, I'm grateful for your coverage of teens' mental health. I have observed many of the conditions described in your articles and in the accompanying video. Well, that was very complimentary, actually. But here comes the critique. One element that I think was underplayed, in fact, it wasn't there at all in any of the articles, was the effect of teens' external environments on their mental health. We are living in the midst of climate collapse. We have to work harder and take on more debt to afford the same things people enjoyed 50 years ago. Our healthcare system is in shambles. Racial injustice and economic equality persist unabated. And, of course, teens recognize, especially those who don't meet the competitive standards in our schools, that their future is extremely precarious. A family wage job is harder and harder to find.
Yeah,
why don't you comment?
I think I've been interested in the history of adolescence, and child psychiatry have written quite a bit about it, the history of diagnoses as they're applied to youth. And it's interesting how the child guidance movement and the concept of adolescence coined by G. Stanley Hall, a psychologist in 1904, they were really reacting to a wave of concern in cities around the U.S. and in London to truancy and juvenile delinquency and a concern about gangs. And so this child guidance movement had much of that same ethos you're describing in the letter, that young people are getting in trouble because they're entering into a society that is demanding new things of them. They're mobile in ways that leave them unanchored. So the concerns about youth as a group that is kind of in this threshold state between the protected sphere of childhood and the responsibilities we're expecting of people to take on as adults, this kind of threshold into the adult world, has for over a century been framed in different ways, some through a criminal justice movement, you know, the crackdown on drugs during the rise of neoliberalism in the late 20th century, more kids arrested for drugs, and returning vets being seen as drug addicts, even though there was data that challenged that assumption that vets were chronic drug addicts, that there's been this concern about how young adults are coping with the world we've created for them. And a more, I guess, progressive wing of this movement that goes all the way back to the child guidance movement that looks at not just diagnosing kids, and in fact approaches diagnosis in a very kind of soft way, and instead sees kids as acting out of real dilemmas, what G. Stanley called the storms and stress of young adulthood and adolescence. And I think we're seeing that now with some calling for better diagnostic tools, expanding hospital beds, more treatment facilities, which has a place in the mental health system, but others who are saying, look, we have to look at the kind of society we're bringing kids into and everyday suffering that is part of that, that can't be framed through these diagnostic categories that we have available. So I think there's a lot to be said for the response of that letter to the editor.
Yeah, I recall when I was growing up, I went to a working class high school. But there are a lot of middle-class kids there, too, and striving kids. Quite a number of the, especially young men, were pretty tough and were getting into trouble. And for some of them, they wound up in the juvenile court or in the court system itself, if they were over 17 or whatever it was. And the judges would give them a sentence and then say it's waived if you enter the Army. And these kids, most of them, in fact, did that. They had no other source of employment, really, and weren't sure of how to get it. And then they came out of the Army, and they were able to get in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I grew up. There were manufacturing jobs, and these guys went into unionized plants.
Yeah, and able to buy houses.
And they were able to buy a home and raise a family and send their kid to college and maybe even buy some golf clubs and play on the public links. It was a very different world. I mean, the Army followed by a good job that paid well and then a marriage and children created a life for these guys. That's not available now. And indeed, the Army... Well, of course, you could go into the Army, but that's afterwards. There's many, many, many veterans on the streets now. It seems to me we're in a different world for people, and the troubles of young people become enormously magnified because of the lack of a future that they see.
Yeah, and I'd like to also weigh in on the framing of that history from a mental health perspective. I think there's an interesting set of trends that I've followed over the last century or more, where including the women's movement, late 19th century, spawned a wave of interest in diagnosing women and also criminalizing abortion. That's another aspect of these historical trends is, you know, when there's a campaign against the rights of youth or the rights of women to control their own bodies. But with the anti-war movement, with some of the youth movements of the 50s and 60s, the free speech movement, there was a wave of interest in child psychiatry or youth and adolescent psychiatry that emerged to frame the problems of youth in psychiatric terms. So even though I'm a psychologist, I'm always wary of when mental health people come into the social problem field and use their expertise to, as we say, name the problem. And, you know, for a very long time now, attention deficit disorder has gotten a lot of press, whether youth are being overdiagnosed and overtreated or what is basically a social condition and a pathologizing of some of the fluctuating, varying attention spans of youth that get framed as a disorder. And even though there are a lot of limits on psychiatry and how it can diagnose youth, especially personality disorders, that can be very damning to receive a diagnosis of a personality disorder. There are limits on how you can apply those categories. But there are, I think, ongoing struggles in the health and mental health field over how much of the problem is underdiagnosed or failure to treat serious mental disorders versus all of the other sources of distress that are captured in many of the same surveys of youth and mental health. For example, there are, 20% or so of adolescents who say they feel chronically lonely or isolated. There are 20% or so who have had thoughts of killing themselves. That's very different from people who actually attempt suicide. Suicidal ideation is fairly common. And I think collapsing all of these together loses sight of what G. Stanley Hall said over a century ago, that adolescence and the entry into adulthood is a time of storm and stress, of figuring out where you land. And of course, as inequality is heightened and the fortunes and destinies of youth from very privileged families are quite a bit different now in terms of access to college, access to housing, access to secure employment, versus the growing number of youth who are trying to find their way in a much more uncertain world. But we also live now in a time where youth are organizing through the climate movement, even around mental health issues and the pandemic. Youth in many states, including Oregon, have fought for excuse from school for mental health reasons, as well as health, have led a lot of the organizing around the country to reduce the flow of guns and military weapons, which is highly associated with suicidality and successful suicides, is whether you have an access to a weapon and know how to use it. So there are, I think, always these threshold anxieties about a crisis among youth when youth themselves become more organized around their anger and the demands on adults in their society.
I'm talking to Jan Hocken. Jan Hocken's a practicing psychologist. Jan, one thing that was not mentioned at all in the Times thing is what you brought up. I think we should get into that in more detail. The organization of teens, which again, I thought was notable at almost at every level. They're really challenging the world that was given to them, and in articulate ways. They really are sophisticated beyond their years. Not all, but a sufficient number to, in fact, have a strong public presence. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's interesting to follow the research and discourse that emerged last year around the criticisms of Facebook and whether it had fostered a dangerous trend of self-mutilation and suicidality among teenage girls. And there was much alarm about that, the impact of social media on youth, but particularly girls. It kind of echoed a similar kind of moral panic in the 80s and 90s over video games and boys, whether the availability of video games is causing all this psychopathic acting out among teenage boys and poisoning their minds and turning them into zombies. And a lot of that was debunked in terms of how boys have a more complex way of interacting with these games, and children do seek each other out and don't normally isolate for long periods of time. And the critics downplayed the more complex ways that kids use the tools of their time. And I think that similarly with social media, it's kind of interesting how a lot of the forward-looking mental health thinkers around the globe now are talking about youth organizing self-help and digital services, social media-based services for reaching out to each other around mental health concerns, but also around mobilizing for political organizing and building social movements. And, you know, I think the way youth organized around the country around gun violence and school walkouts around that a few years ago with minimal impact, as we see, although there's a shift now in going after gun manufacturers, which is, I think, a new phase of that. But yeah, the ways that young people are organized, including in being less reluctant to identify so-called mental health issues, seeing yourself as not neurotypical, seeing yourself along a continuum of gender identities and having tendencies toward depression or anxiety. And these are, of course, artifacts in the screening questionnaires and tools available, the number of people that will acknowledge that they've thought about ending their lives. Because that there's a long history of taboo around that, where particularly the Catholic Church, the Christian churches in general, identify suicide as a sin, and it's a highly closeted source of tragedy in many families to have a family member kill themselves. But youth are much more, I think, open about this to the extent that there are generational cohort effects, which could be itself challenged. But there seems to be something about youth as an organizing category generationally that's certainly been taken up in the climate movement and social justice movements around gender justice, racial justice. So I would be cautious about framing what's going on now as a mental health crisis or emergency versus a time of tremendous peril and inequality that requires a political response, a transformative political response on the part of the governing interests. And youth are speaking out more about the governing interests and institutions that are taking us all toward a sadder and more perilous fate.
Right. Let's get further into the destigmatization that's going on now of the admissions by various athletes, for example, like Naomi Osaka, the tennis champion who retired for a year to deal with her mental health problems, now back on the circuit. Especially young people were enormously both, it seems to me, sympathetic with her and welcomed the direct way she dealt with it. I'm sure there were others before her, but even football players now, these helmeted robots, you know, sort of the height of masculinity and power and some brutality, they are now admitting to having problems of, they call it mental health, with problems where they doubt themselves, where they're fearful, all of the many human things that happen. That in the period, at least when I grew up, you had a stiff upper lip.
Yeah, the military launched a very ambitious campaign during the height of deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, where soldiers were serving multiple deployments, and they rolled out a de-stigma campaign around access to mental health services. It takes a strong soldier to get help. Those posters were everywhere at the VA. And, you know, in many ways, that was a good trend and responded to what was going on in the culture generally, in that young people were less afraid to acknowledge vulnerability and many of the conditions that had been stigmatized as mental health problems. I mean, I think it's also interesting to see Greta Thunberg and her openness about her autism as a leader in a movement where her oddness is an asset. And I think that's been really important for people to identify along what's called the spectrum, to have insights and to be seen as part of a social movement. It's always interesting to me how the mental health issues part of the discourse gets framed within the context of a larger social problem. And often clinicians very much narrow the context of this distress or this reaction or this symptom. But youth themselves are taking up, I think, collectively interesting ways of framing their own distress as a response to the horrifying predictions about a world that may be uninhabitable within decades and that calls for transformative social action and political action. So I think to the extent that youth are organizing and allowing space to support each other and acknowledging the costs of distress and despair and feelings of hopelessness, but holding something together, creating these spaces where people can come together and act collectively, is, I think, the promising signs of mental health resiliency, as it's called among youth.
Jan, you concluded with one of your technical terms. Just out of the world of academic and theoretical psychology with a radical sensibility. You're a...
I've been influenced by the radical psychiatry movement.
You're a
important part of the social movements of the 60s and 70s. Yeah, that took up even having a psychotic episode as a reaction to an irrational social order. There's a long history of turning psychiatry on its head and saying, who are the crazy ones here in this world that we inhabit?
Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Okay, thanks, Bill. We'll have to check in again on this.
Yes, thank you.